This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. 14 seasons after it began, the Comedy Central animated series South Park still hits bullseyes and draws the ire of several of its targets for its very pointed satire. Its 200th episode, shown earlier this year, was the latest to make headlines for the outrage it evoked, this time for depicting Mohammed as a character drawn in a bear suit. Our guests today are the creators of the series, Matt Stone and Trey Parker, who also do most of the voices for the show. South Park is about four children in a small Colorado town, but the subject matter is usually pretty adult, satirizing the right and the left, religion, identity politics, issues in the news, and along with the satire, you get a lot of crude jokes about bodily functions. When the show won a Peabody Award in 2005, the citation said, quote, "In the process of unapologetically ridiculing individuals and groups, the series pushes viewers to confront broader issues, such as racism, war, mob mentality, consumerism, and religious fanaticism." Unquote. Here's a scene from this season's opening episode, which was titled Sexual Healing. The government is trying to grapple with an apparent epidemic of sexual addiction. After being tested at school, Kyle and Butters are diagnosed as sex addicts. They're sent to an institute to be treated, along with a group of famous men whose infidelities have led to scandals, including Tiger Woods, David Letterman, and Bill Clinton. An instructor addresses the group.
All righty, now, we all know the destructive behaviors that got us into this predicament, don't we? What is the main thing we've all learned to avoid? Yes, Tiger?
Avoid drugs and alcohol?
No, Tiger, you still aren't getting it. In order to make sure we are no longer destroying our lives with any of these behaviors, we must avoid anyone? Avoid getting anyone?
Caught.
Yes, Michael Douglas, everyone!
Getting caught.
Very good. You are all here in therapy because you got caught. So how do we avoid getting caught? Ben Roethlisberger.
Don't girls in the public bathrooms. When they ask you for money, pay them.
Good, yes.
Well, hang on. We shouldn't be learning how not to get caught. We have to take responsibility for our actions.
What the f*** are you talking about?
South Park creators Matt Stone and Trey Parker spoke with Terry Gross in March of this year. Before, their episode with Mohammed dressed in a bear costume, but after they had gotten in trouble for a previous episode about opposition to any depiction of Mohammed. In fact, Matt Stone told Terry that when he and Trey Parker first saw newspaper coverage of hostile Muslim reaction to Danish political cartoons portraying Mohammed, they thought the story was referring to South Park.
You picked up the newspaper, it said Cartoon Wars, right? Didn't it say Cartoon Wars?
Yeah, it's called Cartoon
Wars. And it was like, my first thought was like, oh, God. Oh, we did. You know what I mean? Like, we did it.
Well, that said Muslims very upset over racist cartoon. Oh, and we're like, oh, they
crap,
figured
that's us
out.
Yeah. Oh, no. So most of the time, if it's anything like that, we just instantly assume it's us because there's been many times where – there has been a lot of times where we've opened up the paper, pulled up the Drudge Report or something, and it's like, South Park does this. And you're like, oh, God, what do we do? And you find out from the paper, you know, or the internet in real time.
Usually when a cartoon makes people angry, it's us.
So we were actually kind of jealous. We were angry that someone else had stolen our thunder.
So you got even by doing a South Park Muslim cartoon.
Yeah, we're like, okay, well,
episode.
Let's do it. We took it back from the damn Danish.
We said, we're going to do that. If anybody's going to get mad at us. Yeah.
After you did the episode, Comedy Central, which broadcasts your show, which shows South Park, was pretty upset about it, and you ended up having to pull a scene.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, because of the nature of our show, a lot of people by now kind of know that we really do the show almost like a live show, almost like a Saturday Night Live kind of schedule, where we come in on a Thursday and say, "All right, what are we doing this week?" And then that episode airs the next Wednesday. And so it's funny because in our show, what happens then all the time is basically what's going on that week is what ends up going on in the show. And so with that episode, you know, we're saying, okay, and at the end, we're going to show the image of Muhammad. And Comedy Central's like, well, no, you're not. And we're like, no, but you see, we have to, because this is the point we're making, is that it, you know, and we kept being this fight. And so then the fight ended up getting put into the show. And then as we're writing, we're like, okay, let's put the head of the network in there and have him, you know, it's just like, it's always kind of as we're living it that, you know, the show gets made.
And we sent them the show. We said, okay, you can pull it out. but we are going to put a thing that says you pulled it out right here.
Right. And you can pull it out, but we're not going to.
Yeah, we're not going to, and then we worked it into the show.
You want to describe what the wording was on the...
Well, all it was, I mean, I can't remember exactly what we said, but the whole original idea, too, was that we said, you know, they're so upset that they showed an image of Muhammad, which was so funny because we had actually done it like 3 years before that on South Park. We had Muhammad in this episode called Super Best Friends.
There's an image of Muhammad in the head credits of South Park, which is on every episode of South Park that airs in like 100 countries. And it airs in syndication all over the country.
And so they said, you cannot show an image of Muhammad. And we're like, okay, well, so we're going to do it again. And then we said, you know, but we could get attacked by terrorists if we do that. So let's make it look like it was Family Guy and not us. So then that gave us the whole idea for the show that we would put Family Guy in the show and only have Muhammad appear in the Family Guy part. So if they ever saw a still of it on the internet or they ever saw anything, they'd know it was Family Guy, not us.
Yeah.
And then they would get bombed and
we're
not
pretty
us.
Tough, but we're not really that tough.
Yeah, no.
So I'm sure you know about this, that one of the recent news stories that involve South Park has to do with Blackwater, the very controversial, always in the news, private security company that is under investigation and had a big presence in Iraq. And the story is that Blackwater managed to divert hundreds of weapons from a U.S. weapons bunker in Afghanistan to equip Afghan policemen. And on at least one occasion, somebody claiming to work for Blackwater signed for a weapons shipment using the name Eric Cartman, who is, of course, a character from South Park. So when you read something like this in the news, are you flattered? Like, yeah, it's a shout out to one of our characters, or are you appalled?
I think our first instinct is always, how do we put this in the show?
Because, yeah, we've already been talking about how we can work that into a show.
Anytime we read anything remotely interesting, we try to think how we could put it in the show, and so especially if it's about ourselves. But when I read that, I had a small feeling of just like, oh, I think Cartman actually did that. Like, he seems very real to me, and so I think maybe that really was him.
Yeah, how do we know it wasn't him?
South Park is frequently topical. So I want to play an excerpt from a show that aired in season 13, which was the last season. This is an episode that was called Margaritaville. And this was basically your take on the financial meltdown. But of course, it has to be seen through a third grader's eyes. So Stan goes into the bank where he has $100, and he meets the banker. And so here's the banker and Stan.
How can I help you, young man?
I got a $100 check from my grandma, and my dad said I need to put it in the bank so it can grow over the years.
Well, that's fantastic. A really smart decision, young man. We can put that check in a money market mutual fund. Then we'll reinvest the earnings into foreign currency accounts with compounding interest, and it's gone.
What?
It's gone. It's all gone.
What's all gone?
The money in your account. It didn't do too well. It's gone.
What do you mean? I have $100.
Not anymore, you don't. Poof.
Well, what can I do to get back
I'm sorry, sir, but this line is for bank members only.
I just opened an account.
Do you have any money invested with this bank?
No, you just lost it all.
Then please stand aside for people who actually have money with us. Next, please.
Hey!
Hello, Mrs. Farnickel. How are you today? Making a deposit, are we? Great. We can just put that into your retirement account and make it go to work for you, and it's gone.
That's really funny. But I love the idea of Stan going to the bank and trying to deposit his $100 and then poof, it's gone.
Yeah, that was actually, it's one of those things, you know, the way we always kind of do shows is way more like kind of sculpting because we will start on Thursday or Friday and we'll sometimes just, I think we started doing sort of more of the God metaphor stuff first. And then as that kept going, it got kind of trippier and trippier. We're like, all right, we need something to just really be a runner through this that's just more present day, what's going on, and
something grounding, sort of, something kind of start in a real place, you know.
Then added on all the stuff with Stan, and that's how shows go a lot. Sometimes we'll write the end first, sometimes we write the beginning first, and sometimes we write the middle first.
Yeah, and that scene is definitely like your whole life. You're told if you just put money in the bank, it'll go up in value.
Yeah. Now, the characters in South Park, after 15 years, have advanced from third grade to fourth grade. But
yeah, they're not doing too good.
They're not doing good. But you, on the other hand, have gotten 15 years older in the interim. So do you see the world differently than you did when you started writing the show? And are you writing the characters from a different point of view?
I would love to say yes, but I don't think we've really grown up.
Haven't matured at all.
We're still basically doing fart jokes.
Yeah, thanks for rubbing it on our face. But
no, I mean, I think it's really funny when we look back, especially even now when we look back at seasons 3 and 4. You know, it used to be when we look back at seasons 1 and 2, we were just like, oh my God, we had no idea what we were doing. That's not funny. That's not well written. Because it was really through the process of doing the movies, you know, especially like the South Park movie and then doing other stuff like that, that really where we learned really how to be writers. We didn't really know how to do that. We were just kind of faking it. And we also through the years, we got really into the writing side of it. Like we never sit in our writer's room and crack jokes. It's just not what we're about. We really sit there and write it, really try to think through stuff that is just cool over the whole 20 minute that's like more conceptual, and we just get into that stuff way more now than we did when we were, you know, 26.
But it's still all in service of fart jokes. So
yeah,
it's like elegant fart jokes now. Yeah. It's like finely tuned fart jokes. We're better at writing those.
The first episode was kind of geared around fart jokes.
Yes, right. Absolutely.
Were those jokes like really important to you when you were in third grade?
Oh, of course.
Yeah, I mean that was the. Yeah, that was all you had to joke about because you hadn't had sex yet. Isn't somebody saying that? You know, all you have is poo and farts.
That was your sexual life.
It's just poo and farts. So that's like the biggest thing you got going. That's the most subversive thing you can talk about.
Why do you want to see the world from the point of view of fourth graders?
Well, it started off as really just a, you know, way back in 97 when we started this, it really felt like it was still at a time when so much of the entertainment was coming out was all about, oh, the innocence of a child. And if we could only see the, you know, world through the eyes of children and, you know, if we could just all be children again. And we were kind of going, all right, well, we were children not that long ago. And I don't remember me or anyone else being that cool. like we were pretty much little bastards, you know, that needed. And so we're like, well, no, let's do a show where kids are really the way kids really are. And that was really one of the big ideas of the show is let's just have kids talk the way they talk. And, you know, and back then, you know, way back in the dark ages when we started this, that's sort of what people really responded to was like, whoa, what's this, you know? And so, and now I think there's also an added element where it's always nice because kids can have an opinion that's always kind of in the middle. And so many of the shows, you know, it's not, the formula is not that, hard to find. I mean, it really is that we take an issue and we sort of always have two sides about to kill each other over it, and the boys in the middle going, doing fart jokes and saying, you know, who cares? This is, you know, you're both crazy. And that's what's nice too. And then in terms of Cartman, it's great because we always thought of him as a little Archie Bunker, and we always loved Archie Bunker as a character. And again, we felt like in the 90s, you just were like, man, you could not have a character like that on TV anymore because, you know, the show would get canceled in a week. And we're like, yeah, but maybe not if that character was an 8-year-old, because people forgive 8-year-olds because, like, well, you know, he's 8. You know, so.
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, Cartman's anti-Semitic, he's homophobic, he's.
All that good stuff.
All that stuff.
All that good stuff. It just has a different. It just isn't quite as. I mean, we can make it pretty. I mean, we make him pretty venomous. But it just isn't. It's just something you can still laugh at because it's this little fat, funny-looking kid.
Yeah.
Where if it was an adult doing that, it's just a different kind of humor.
Trey, you do the voices of Stan and Cartman. Can you tell us how you came up with those voices?
Even in film class, Matt and I would talk with just kind of this annoying, high-pitched voice, and make our film teachers angry.
We thought it was funny, and kind of nobody else did.
Basically. Yeah, and what we did at the time,
what
I remember.
Was the voice?
Well, I mean, it was basically all the voices of the kids. But what's funny is that we do the voices. Back then, we did the voice, and then it was on analog tape. God, this is weird to talk about.
So it weird,
was on,
right?
It was on analog tape.
We had a 4-track.
And we took this thing bent the thing to pitch it up. Because the truth is, if I were to do Stan right now or to do Cartman, it wouldn't sound like him. Because, of course, now it's all digital. But we do the voices, and then they take the waveform, and they pitch it up exactly 3 semitones, which is what we now know kind of sounds like a kid. 2 semitones can make you sound kind of like a woman, and 4 makes you sound like Terrence and Phillip. You know, it's 6
makes you sound like a chipmunk.
Yeah.
So is there
it is weird.
What's the difference between how you do Stan and how you do Cartman?
It's funny too, because just I've noticed with a lot of cartoons, but it's funny to look back at, you know, the first few seasons and how much different it was. Because it used to just be all through my – and just puffing my chest out and really going, like that. You couldn't even understand what he was saying, you know. And so now it's just, you know, through the years he's gotten this little accent and there's just certain words that he pronounces a certain way for no reason and little nuances that, you know – and there'll be plenty of times we catch ourselves that – I'll do Stan's voice, and I'm like, oh, wait, that sounded like Cartman. And because they're not close. That different. It's right. Just one's kind of more through my nose and has a few different accents on words, and the other one's just pretty much my voice talking high.
And Matt, do you want to say anything about doing the voices that you do?
No, just that I'm not very good at voices. So, like, it's lucky
well, you do
that
Kyle.
I,
you do it on a... You did Kyle,
yeah,
you did Kenny.
Well, Kyle and Stan are basically me and Trey doing the exact same voice. It's just that one is – they're slightly different. Kenny is speaking to my hand. It's a brilliant technique.
Always the funniest thing because, like, if I'm wasted enough, like, at a party and people come in like, do a voice. I was like, okay, who do you want? They always say Kenny. And I'm like, okay, I don't do Kenny. And why do you want Kenny? Like, all that is talking into your hand.
Matt, do Kenny. This is the perfect setup. Now you got to do Kenny.
Oh, yeah.
And talking to
okay,
your
what
hand.
You do, take your hand. You hold your fingers together and you put it over your mouth like this. Amazing.
Isn't that incredible?
Amazing.
Incredible voice. The way you can just change his voice like that. But I mean, I really love, you know, like the favorite times we have, even writing, but also in the room recording is when we're being Cartman and Butters. Because we just know, those are just times we almost know every time we're going to get in there, we're going to do it in one take because we just know exactly how those two kids are around each other.
Those are two characters that are just – and you can almost give them normal lines that aren't funny and they can become funny. Both those characters are just inherently super funny. Those are the funnest shows. Those are the most fun shows to do is Cartman and Butters.
You guys were friends before you started working on South Park. Did you know each other back in grade school?
No. We met in college.
Okay.
Yeah, we both went to CU. We both grew up in Colorado and we both went to CU Boulder. Because that was the school that basically you went to. If you grew up in Colorado, that's all I remember. It's the only one school I applied to. And we met just like in filmmaking class, you know, in the summer.
And it was in filmmaking class that you teamed up and did a couple of shorts that became the prototype.
Yeah, we really bonded over Monty Python. That was like the first thing that, like, you know, in our film class, it was all people who wanted to be Kurosawa and Martin Scorsese. And they had their, you know, Taxi Driver that they were trying to write. In, you know, in Colorado, and they were going to produce it for $600 somehow. But we were just constantly doing Monty Python sketches, and so that's kind of how we met. And then we started doing shorts because, you know, back in the dark ages of the early 90s, you know, there wasn't any really digital video, and you had to get film stock and shoot it, and that was expensive. So you really couldn't afford anything but a short, and. Something kind of great about that because you had to say, okay, well, we can only do something that's 3 minutes long. How do you make something really good in 3 minutes? And that's kind of all we did when we started.
If you hadn't been assigned to do animation for your film class, would you have ever thought of animation?
It's funny. We actually weren't assigned it at all.
I thought you were. Oh, okay.
And well, no, there actually that's not true. I was in an animation class, and at the end of it, you could either write an essay or make an animated film. And that's when – but that's – Matt and I weren't in that class together. And so I made – that was the first time I worked with construction paper. But again, it was just basically doing Terry Gilliam kind of stuff. And it was so crappy. I mean, it's even way worse looking than South Park. And I got nominated for a Student Academy Award for it, which was just ridiculous. Because if you see it, it's so bad. But then sort of using that same style – and really the only reason was because – since the film screenings were always at the end of the semester, it was always right around Christmas time for the fall semester. And so it was like, it's Christmas time. Let's do a little thing for the festival just for people to get a little – and we just made this little thing with Frosty the Snowman and these four boys and thought really nothing of it except that we wanted to, you know, just really make people laugh and have these little kids cussing and talking about Christmas. And it was just for – that's all we thought of it. And then – a producer at Fox ended up seeing that and saying, hey, I want to send this out as my Christmas card. Okay. And like a year later was like, hey, go make another one of those. And we're like, okay. And again, just we were not thinking anything. Didn't even put our names on it because we didn't think anything of it. And then that just ended up being the thing. It was crazy.
How did you get from there to Comedy Central?
Because the guy, the producer at Fox, who was Brian Graydon, he copied it, and it's so funny to talk about this stuff because
this is
back in the day
VCRs,
where you had to dub it on VCRs. There was no YouTube.
Yeah.
There was no – so he just dubbed 100 copies onto VCR tapes. And the next thing we knew, the tapes were getting copied and copied and copied, and we were hearing about people that were seeing this like 20th generation of this thing on VCR, and it just took off in L.A. And I think partly too because we didn't put our names on it. Everyone's like, who did this? Who did this? And then all of a sudden we were in meetings talking to people who wanted to see it as a show.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Matt Stone and Trey Parker, creators of the animated satirical series South Park. The show, which recently televised its 200th episode, is about a group of fourth graders. But the humor is adult, satirizing politics, religion, celebrities, you name it. Stone and Parker also do most of the voices for the show.
I especially love the musical episodes of the show and the music, the songs that have been in your movies. So I thought I'd play a scene from a recent musical episode, and this was a parody of High School Musical, and your episode was called Elementary School the Musical.
Elementary School Musical.
Elementary School Musical, yeah. And all the kids sing in groups, but one kid, Bryden, decides he doesn't want to sing. So he really wants to play basketball, but he's afraid it will make him unpopular to play basketball, which is, of course, really funny. So he goes home, and he confesses to his parents that he'd rather play basketball than sing. And so here's that scene. He's at the dinner table with his parents.
Sit up properly, Bryden. You know how strict your father is about posture. All right, dear, dinner's ready.
Okay, let's eat.
Dad, I need to talk to you about something.
Ooh, that sounds emotional. What is it, son? What's on your mind? Whatever it is, you know your dad has the time.
No, Dad, can we just talk?
If you can talk it, you can sing it. You can lay down the rhythm and bring it. Just put a melody to the words that you're saying and soon
you'll be... Dad, I want to join the basketball team.
What did you say?
This kid at school today told me I should do what I want to do. That's what I really want to do.
Basketball? No son of mine is going to be a sweaty little jock.
But Dad, it's what I really want.
There's no singing and dancing in basketball.
I know, that's kind of why I like it.
Don't you even think about it. If I had a jock for a son, I'd be the laughingstock of the men's choir club.
It's my life, Dad.
Don't make me slap you. I will slap your face so super hard.
It's a topsy-turvy world. That is so funny. I love the father kind of singing instead of talking. Trey, I got the impression you really love musicals.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I didn't even have, growing up sort of in the foothills of Colorado, I definitely didn't have much of a theater experience to be able to have, but it was because we had this little playhouse called the Evergreen Players, and it was this little, 40 seat theater, and it was always one of your teachers and the guy that worked at the gas station and the librarian that were always, cast in whatever musical and doing it, and that was my exposure to all the great musicals were seeing it that way. And that's why I fell in love with them so much, because it was just like I knew all these people and they were always putting on a different show every couple months. And that's how I learned what all the great musicals were. It wasn't until I was about 20 that I actually came up to New York and saw a real musical.
One of the more controversial episodes you did was the Scientology episode that was called, was it called In the Closet?
Mm-hmm.
Trapped in the Closet.
Trapped in the Closet, yeah. And it was actually a very funny episode. Where Stan is, because Stan goes to a Scientology personality test and he scores so well on it, he's seen as the second coming of L. Ron Hubbard. And because Tom Cruise is a Scientologist, Tom Cruise pays a visit to Stan's home and is so disappointed to hear that Stan doesn't think that Tom Cruise is as good an actor as Leonardo DiCaprio or the dude who plays Napoleon Dynamite. So crestfallen, Tom Cruise walks into Stan's bedroom closet, and here's what happens.
I'm nothing. I'm a failure in the eyes of the prophet. Ah!
Hey! Dude, I'm sorry. I didn't mean it.
Go away.
Dude, this is my room.
Go away, I said.
Dad! Tom Cruise won't come out of the closet!
What?
Tom Cruise locked himself in my closet and he won't come out!
Mr. Cruz? Mr. Cruz, come out of the closet.
No.
Come on, Mr. Cruz. This is ridiculous.
I'm never coming out.
What did you say to him?
I just told him I thought Napoleon Dynamite guy is a better actor than he is.
Oh, boy. Mr. Cruz, you can't just stay in the closet, all right? You need to come out.
What's going on?
Tom Cruise won't come out of the closet.
What?
Just leave me alone.
Well, we can't leave you alone because you won't come out of the closet.
So that's a scene from the Trapped in the Closet episode of South Park. My guests are the creators of the show, Trey Parker and Matt Stone. So you ran into real trouble with this episode. You were afraid you'd get sued, I think, by the Scientologists. But it was actually, I think, Tom Cruise's people that asked for the show to be pulled.
We're pretty sure.
And in fact, yeah, I think it was.
We can't legally say that, but yeah, we think it
but
was.
Yes. But yes.
Yes,
legally.
We think it was. That's about what we can say legally, I think. But yeah, no, I mean, it was a show that it pushed a lot of buttons.
It was a show that also, I think the only reason we got it on the air was because we do this show so close to the deadline that we actually stay up. Our show airs Wednesday night at 10, and we usually are up all night, us and our entire crew up all night the night before finishing. So we'll literally like finish the show at noon on Wednesday. You know, and then it airs just a few hours later. So that we basically Comedy Central Legal looks at our show and Comedy Central Standards and Practices look at our show. But there's a lot of people that literally like it just doesn't have time for somebody to watch it, you know, from beginning to end because it just gets there and then goes on the air. And Legal and Standards have given it their OK. And Legal worked with us on that show and they said, this is fine. This is satire. It's protected and we feel safe about this. And then it went on the air. And it was kind of like all hell broke loose, you know, because Mission Impossible 3 was coming out that summer and the Scientologists started calling, I think, Viacom. And then – but what really happened was a few months later, it kind of died down. The episode was supposed to be rerun just in its normal rerun time. And all of a sudden they called me and Trey and they said, we're going to pull that out of rotation, that episode. And we're like, why? And they're like, well, because certain producers on Mission Impossible 3 would rather not have it on the air. And, you know, our attitude, they kind of, and then they told us that we had to be quiet, and that was a little tough. But we kind of, you know, again, talking about our history on the show, it's not something that would have been able to have happened in the first season of the show. But whenever Trapped in the Closet came on, we're like, this isn't going to work. People are going to find out. And, you know, with the internet, as soon as that was pulled out of rotation, you know, internet boards started going crazy and people figured it out and it became a news story. So we didn't have to do anything. So it's really interesting that the internet really kind of was the thing that broke that story.
So it has been back on the air.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's been back on the air for – and, of course, it made it the most – like you said, like notorious. You're asking us about it.
Yeah.
It's all, you know, it's like the DVD sold crazy. People watch it online all the time. You know, making the story of it backfired.
Well,
you know, so.
I think the last line of that episode is something like – we'll sue you.
Yeah.
So
ahead, sue me.
Yeah.
were you sued by a Scientologist after that
nope.
episode?
No. And that's the thing. You know, we sort of – it was pretty cool because it was one of those episodes where we actually worked pretty closely with the lawyers at Viacom. And the lawyers were kind of into it. It was like, let's do this challenge of doing this and make it unsueable. And they got into that. They're like, no, this kind of sounds fun. Like, and we got in very, you know, there was a few things where it's like, okay, this, you cannot say this word.
Right.
You can't say pyramid scheme.
Like, for instance, they wouldn't let us say pyramid scheme. They wouldn't let us say that Scientology is a pyramid scheme. Now, we're not saying that
right
now on the radio. they wouldn't let us. So we worked with lawyers. And because it's also a big – the show also worked on a meta level of if you know that Scientology has litigious personality, litigious, yeah. Then you know that we were playing with that very personality of Scientology. It was really fun.
Now, you know, the Tom Cruise part where Tom Cruise is in the closet. You know, you're playing on a rumor that was circulating that Tom Cruise was really gay. So did you have any reservations about playing with that rumor, knowing that, you know, it might be hurtful
no,
to
you know,
Tom Cruise?
Since South Park is satire and it's parody, we like putting true rumors in all the time.
True rumors. Trumors, we call it.
We call them trumors.
I mean, that joke was more like, here's a bad joke Because you could just, it's like, okay, but you're saying he's gay. It's like, no, we're just saying he's in the closet. You know, and you're playing upon that rumor, but you're really just playing a bad joke over and over and getting mileage out of it.
Matt Stone and Trey Parker, the creators of South Park, speaking to Terry Gross in March of this year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview from March of this year with Matt Stone and Trey Parker, the creators of the Comedy Central animated series South Park.
Okay, so I want to ask you now about political satire that you've done. You did, let's go back to season 9 for this, another famous episode. This is from Best Friends Forever. This was your take basically on the Terri Schiavo story about her, the big controversy about whether she should be taken off life support or not. And in this episode, Heaven needs Kenny's help because Kenny did so well on a video game defeating a dark empire in a Keanu Reeves video that the Angels thinks he can be their Keanu Reeves and bring down Satan's army. So Kenny dies, but he's brought back to life, and he's on a feeding tube. And doctors say that he's in a persistent vegetative state and they can keep Kenny in the state of a tomato indefinitely with the help of the feeding tube. So Heaven's really upset because now they can't have Kenny on their side. But, you know, then there's this movement to get the feeding tube taken out. And then Satan gets really upset because that means that Heaven might defeat Satan. So Heaven wants him dead. Satan wants him alive. And here's Satan talking with his assistant.
What mockery is this?
My lord.
The feeding tube has been pulled. If the child dies and his soul returns to heaven, God will have his Keanu Reeves.
Perhaps the child won't die in time.
Forget it. I'm calling the attack off.
No. Keep your army marching, my lord. I will get that feeding tube put back in.
How?
I will do what we always do. Use the Republicans.
What happens next in the scene is that Satan's assistant goes to a press conference being held by a Republican congressman and whispers in the Republican congressman's ear the things that the congressman should say.
We Republicans are deeply saddened by the tragic events in Colorado.
Removing the feeding tube is murder.
Removing the feeding tube is murder.
Who are we to decide that Kenny should live or die?
Who are we to decide that Kenny should live or die?
It is God's will that he live.
It is God's will that he live. Ha, ka, 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 ka.
No, no, you don't say that part.
No, no, you don't say that part. Ha, ka, 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 ka.
That's a scene from South Park. My guests are the show's creators, Trey Parker and Matt Stone. That's a really, really funny scene. Now, people are always confused about whether you're liberal or conservative since you mock all political
sides. Yeah, we're confused
sides.
Too.
Yeah.
We're working out our confusion on the air.
We're really jealous of all these people that really seem to have figured it out because we're pretty confused.
Yeah.
Seriously, are you political?
Well, we talk about it. I mean, it's interesting and it becomes we're, you know, adults that live in the world, but I don't think we're not very overtly, we're not really overtly political. Like, I guess our political attitude is South Park's bigger than both the Republicans and the Democrats. And of course, that's a ridiculous statement to everyone in the world but me and Trey. It's just, it's more like our show is more important than any. We would hate the show to feel like, oh, this is where we put our politics in because we want this side to win. You know, we like working out our stuff on, you know, in the show, and we like talking about those issues and talking about the emotions behind the issues, especially because that's where a lot of the fodder comes from. But we would never want people to think that the show is a Democrat show or a Republican show and vote this way because of this. That's just like – it feels dishonest to the show, you know?
And it's just like where so many episodes are like this side of an issue and that side of an issue, and they're all yelling at each other and calling each other evil and stupid, and the boys are in the middle going, God, just both of you shut up. there's a reason the show's like that. It's because that's basically who we are.
I mean, the end of that show, Kenny, who's playing Terry Schiavo, is just like, whatever you do is fine. Just don't put me on TV, you know? And there was a whole, I mean, that entire episode of Terry Schiavo, you're just looking at this poor woman who's on, at the very least, it's like a really complex issue, but like quit showing her face on TV in the worst possible way, you know, over and over. And it just felt like that was an emotional, like, we like to find the thing at the end that we can, like, a third kind of way that and sometimes it's ridiculous and sometimes it's kind of fun, but it's never, like, prescriptive. It's never like, hey, we think the world should do this, because we don't know. And it's a cartoon, by the way. So, and I also think I don't really think we're conservative. I mean, look at that clip you just played from the Terry Schiavo show. But liberals I think that compared to most of Hollywood, maybe we are a little conservative.
Because we will rip on liberals, and most people really have an agenda to, you know,
it's just not that funny when you
push their liberal
on
agenda on their show.
Yeah, and it's just really not, they don't really think it's that funny when the joke's on them. Team America is a good example. We always thought that movie would be funny to start the movie like Charlton Heston is directing it, or the other way around, start it like Michael Moore's directing it, then end it like Charlton Heston's directing it, and kind of rip on everybody. And people, you know, I've never saw it in screenings I went, but people told me about screenings where in Berkeley or in New York City where the crowd's just going crazy for the first half. And then the laughs just kind of like dwindle.
And then people start walking out.
Yeah.
because it does take a turn. And all of a sudden we start ripping on liberals.
That makes me laugh the most.
And it was, you know, because it came out around election time, that's when we got, you know, the letter from Sean Penn saying, How dare you make this movie in support of George Bush? And we're like, what are you talking about?
Did you see the movie?
Did you see it? He was just pissed off that we put him in the movie and made fun of him. That's all he's pissed off of.
There have been several, I think, academic books written about South Park. What's the most what you consider to be tortured intellectual comment about South Park that you've ever read?
I remember one time there was an early review that was – we were just like, after the first show came out, like we were reviewed in the Washington Post or something. Oh, God. And we looked at the review and it was like, well, there are some funny bits, but it doesn't deal with the nihilism of suburban life the way Beavis and Butthead does, or the complexities of the American family like The Simpsons does. And we're like, wow, that's what you see in Beavis and Butthead? You know, like, I didn't really get all of that. there's some really egghead stuff that people have written about South Park. But I guess for us, it's always – every season is kind of like we're a band and we're going in and we're doing a new album.
Were you surprised in 2005 that after many years of poo jokes and obscenities that you were honored with perhaps the highest honor in broadcasting, the Peabody Award?
Yeah, we were surprised. Yeah,
we were a little surprised. Yeah, that we would.
It did come after it was a crazy season, and it was around the time of the Scientology episode and like the Imagination Land episode where. I mean, we do take pride in our work. We do work very, very hard, and we do love the craft of writing, and we do talk about it constantly, and we do our homework. We really do. And so, it's still, no matter how long we've been doing it, a lot of people think that they've always thought that basically we just get high and do stuff, and it becomes a show.
And I wish.
It's just such the opposite. Yeah. You know, it's like when we're in a season – it's this insane grind and our brains are hurting and we're working really hard because we want the shows to be really good and we don't accept, you know, mediocrity. We get mad at ourselves when we feel like we've done something poorly and we try it again.
I mean, the thing with the Peabody and the Emmy, the first time we were nominated for Emmy, we had to get over that feeling of like, no, that's like we're the punk rock band. We're the people that flip our finger at the establishment kind of thing. And then so the first time you get an Emmy, you're kind of like, that doesn't really fit us. But
it's like
kind of grudgingly.
Student of the month.
Yeah, like student of the month. You're like, I don't want to be student of the month. And then eventually, you're like, that's pretty cool.
What did you say at the ceremony?
Much. We just talked
about how sweet Battlestar Galactica was because they got one too.
Battlestar Galactica got one, and that was the first season of that show, which was phenomenal. So we dedicated our award to Battlestar Galactica.
Because remember when we learned that we got a Peabody, we're like, we got a Peabody. And we're like, what else got a Peabody? And we're like, Battlestar Galactica. And we're like, we didn't even know there was a new one out. We're like, what? And then we got the DVDs and like watched them all back to back. And we're like, whoa, this is really good. So then we just talked about how good that show was.
Yep, that's what we did.
Well, I want to congratulate you on your 200th episode. And I want to thank you very much for coming here and talking with us.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
South Park creators Matt Stone and Trey Parker speaking to Terry Gross in March of this year. You can find links to every South Park episode mentioned during our interview on our website, freshair.npr.org. the Sex and the City juggernaut continues with the second feature film based on the HBO series. The four female protagonists are still friends. Three of them are married now, but in this film, they leave New York and head to Abu Dhabi. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
I am currently embroiled in several email exchanges about Sex and the City 2 with three female friends and colleagues. We all dislike it. No, dislike isn't the word. We think it's appalling. The difference is that I, who had a love-hate relationship with the series, find it easy to lob insults, while they feel betrayed. They could live with the first movie, but here comes Sex and the City 2 to turn something that either challenged or inspired or just gave them a blessed escape into an all-out drag show with arch one-liners and product placements and almost no emotional heft. The Sex and the City dynamic has always been fragile. At its most affecting, you could see beyond the materialism and artifice and feel the four female protagonists, Carrie and Miranda and Samantha and Charlotte, fighting for validation and connecting with one another via that struggle. They were dissimilar, but that was the point. They didn't threaten one another. They weren't catty in the way that so many female friendships are falsely portrayed on screen. They could empathize, but also offer detached and witty perspectives. And Carrie could try to sum it all up in her column. Now, in Sex and the City 2, there's nothing left but surface. And what a surface. The movie is written and directed by Michael Patrick King, and I can almost hear him cackling as he cooked it up. Let's start with an over-the-top gay wedding with Liza Minnelli marrying the couple. Then we'll send the girls to Abu Dhabi so they can rile up the fundamentalists with their revealing clothes and flagrant sexuality. Then they'll make fun of women in traditional black Muslim garb with lines like, "Certainly cuts down on the Botox bill." But later, they'll join these repressed women in campy feminist solidarity. And won't our girls look great, swishing around the desert, being waited on by smooth young Arab men? Well, no, they don't look great. And with their plastic smiles and forced gaiety, scene after scene is cringeworthy. This scene is actually the best of them, a lunch in which Kim Cattrall's Samantha lays out her vitamins and pills, while Sarah Jessica Parker's Carrie and Cynthia Nixon's Miranda look on in amazement.
Wow, that's a whole lot of health. How many you work in there?
44. I'm on the one-a-day Fruity Pebbles plant. Women our age shouldn't joke about vitamins.
Women who are not our age shouldn't say women our age.
Well, one day, very soon, you will thank me. I am leading the way through the menopause maze with my vitamins, my melatonin sleep patches, my bioidentical estrogen cream, progesterone cream, a touch of testosterone.
She's the hormone whisperer.
I am. I've tricked my body into thinking it's younger.
I've tricked my body into thinking it's thinner. Spanx.
And I'm telling you, no hot flashes, no mood swings in my sex drive. It's right back to where it was.
Really? Hadn't heard.
At least that scene introduces the theme of aging. But the rest of the time, Cattrall is in skimpy dresses, throwing herself at studly males. There is a nominal plot. Since Carrie and Chris Noth's Mr. Big got married, he wants to stay home and watch old movies, while she wants to go out. Miranda has troubles with her boss. Charlotte is taxed by motherhood. In Abu Dhabi, where they accompany Samantha on a PR trip at the behest of a sheikh, Carrie bumps into an old flame, Aiden, and feels a tug. But like every other scene, this one is full of melodramatic gestures, and the director's timing is so bad, you can see every joke limping its way toward you from across the desert. In a movie in which every entrance is meant to make you cry, fabulous, in which Carrie's outfits cost as much as $50,000, it's worth saying that the designers, and especially the cinematographer, have not flattered the actresses. And Sarah Jessica Parker, a good comedian with endearing rocky poise, looks better when she's not swanning around. For all the smutty double entendres, Sex and the City 2 is a pale shade of vanilla. Except for one scene. Catral, stuffed in short shorts in the Arab marketplace, has a flurry of hot flashes, drops to the ground, and writhes around, moaning, "I have sex, yes, I quite enjoy it." Samantha's identity is so invested in her audacious sexuality that all the contradictions produce a convulsive fit, a fugue state. The scene pushes the boundaries. I frankly had to avert my eyes. But at least it connects with real longing, real desperation, in ways that the rest of Sex and the City 2 doesn't come near.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can see clips from Sex and the City 2 at our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirsfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Inculi.